This is Radical Love Life, an ongoing series of podcasts and special events where we explore faith outside the boxes. Hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
No, how are you?
Great.
How are you?
Thanksgiving, making sure I have a good appetite and that I'm ready to have interesting conversations with my family. How about you?
Yes, it does sound like you are going to have some interesting conversations over Thanksgiving. For me, I'm prepared as well. I'm going to see some family who we have great conversation around our table. It's a side of my family that I love deeply. It's my aunt and uncle who both have their degrees in theology and have been educators. And my uncle's written a number of books as well. So it's fun conversations, but they're conversations where there's not conflict, but where we can find commonality and common ground that's built on love and the things that we make us better souls. And so it's always a joyous time when we're together.
In my family, we get around there too, but there's a lot of kind of heated rabbinical type conversation and debate along the way. And I'm also going to get to see my wife's family and my family. So I'm going to go from the Greek Sephardic Jews to the Southern Baptist, Whitey McWhiterson's. It's going to be definitely an interesting time.
It will be diverse for you, my friend.
All right.
So what are we talking about today?
Yeah, what are we talking about today? We have an awesome guest that's going to join us here, Camille Hernandez. And Camille has recently published a book. It's called The Hero and the Whore.
Wow. That's a powerful title.
And we're going to dig into that. And I love how she describes herself in her prologue of the book. I'm going to read it. This is her own words here. I am a cishet female in a patriarchal society. I'm a mixed race in a culture that prefers monolithic models of identity. I'm Black and Filipina in a society built by whiteness. I'm a queer-affirming, poor, second-generation American, first-generation college student, and a survivor of violence. I'm a minister, educator, and a storyteller.
Wow, there's so much there. I can't wait to get this conversation going.
And let's do it. And Camille, hello.
Hi, hello.
Welcome. We're so grateful that you're joining us today.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Yes, indeed. Bill, the book is just out, right? And tell me, who did you write this for?
I wrote this for me. That's probably like super selfish to say, but
no, it's not.
Thank you. At first, I wrote it to educate out of my own grief, like to educate people. And the more that I wrote it, the more I was like, yeah, but it's not authentic to me, which is ironic because I'm an educator. I have my master's degree in education. I was like, it's not authentic to me if I center someone else's learning and forget what is true of me and for me. I think two chapters into the book, I shifted and then just started writing what I wanted to know, what I wanted to see, but also connecting these really big dots for me in regards to like society and colonization and imperialism and global relations as a Black and Filipina person. Yeah, I decided that if I'm going to write a book, that's everything, then I'm gonna write so that I can see myself, because that is important and it's honoring, and there is a very lovely uniqueness in my own identity. But the more I wrote for me, the more I realized I was writing for a whole host of people.
Yeah, that motivation drives a lot of really good books, because they often give the advice of write what. But I've also heard the writing advice of write the book that you want to read. Write the book that you have looked for on the shelves and haven't been able to find. And that's usually a great way to create something that's unique to your voice, even if you're covering territory others have covered.
Yeah. That reminds me of Toni Morrison. She wrote The Bluest Eye because she's an avid reader. And she wrote it because it's the book that she wanted to read as an avid reader, mm-hmm. and spent like a decade on it, I think. a very long period of time because she was like, it's not quite interesting for me to read yet. So
right.
I resonate with.
Can you tell us a little bit about your history of like how you got to where you are? Most folks, they have there's my journey started here and it got me here. And that's how I ended up in the place to write this book or create this vision.
My journey started before I was born. My mom won't use the title refugee, but in my mind, she left the Philippines to seek refuge. She left during the Marcos regime when there was martial law and they're very poor. I think at one point it was like 8 people in a 1-bedroom apartment in like the slums of Manila, which is the biggest city in the Philippines.
Wow.
But she and the family left by way of U.S. imperialism because a lot of Filipinos were able to migrate to the Philippines by way of recruitment into the U.S. Navy. I am a product in that way of U.S. imperialism. So that's like a very complicated thing to hold on to. And my dad is from the Mississippi Delta. So when he was 11 years old, Emmett Till was murdered about 20 miles away from his hometown. And my dad, in his own way, was a freedom fighter. He marched and led and participated in organized efforts to end segregation in certain parts of his town. I think they successfully desegregated a movie theater and then attempted to desegregate a library before he had to flee. So in his own way, he fled too.
Oh,
and he's a part of the immigration. So he migrated from Mississippi to Detroit and then to California. That's where both my parents met. And then they had me, which was just the pinnacle of their lives. Just, I grew up with my mom's side heavily, very Filipino Catholic. I come from a very praying family, like a Catholic traditions praying family. I was in that tradition with them for most of my childhood, except for when I'd visit family on my dad's side. And then it was like the Black Lutheran Church or like the Black Missionary Baptist Church. In high school, I ventured out into like white evangelicalism just for a year. It's like my senior year of high school. And then I went to college where I was immersed in the Black Missionary Baptist Church, was very active. But after college, I moved back in with my parents and didn't really know, felt really hopeless, was in my little quarter life crisis, and then joined the evangelical church I was in high school, and I was there for 10 years. And I left in 2020. And now I'm just in this really interesting, odd place of recognizing that I'm deeply spiritual and I'm a follower of Jesus and but also wanting to test the boundaries and limits and go beyond those boundaries and limits and see what happens.
Yes. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
I read something that is in one of the elements that's in the book, and it says, I was raised in a Christianity that was built whole theologies on lies, blame, and dehumanization. And that's something that I identify with as well, in that your journey going through all this, and you say you're in an odd space, but when you look back, especially you name your experiences and what it was both in the Catholic Church and your evangelical experiences, and even this past 10 years, you write about that in great details. Can you enlighten us a little bit about that journey and just share a little bit more about how did you get to where you are at this moment?
I ask a lot of questions and I'm very annoying. That's my general answer. Yeah, I have always, faith and spirituality has always been something that's super interesting to me. Uh-huh. Mythology is really interesting to me. But I think I was really fortunate to have an older sibling who was really unafraid to say when something wasn't working for him. And in some way, it felt restrictive for me because, like, he was the rebel and I had to be the good girl. But in other ways, it was really freeing because I was able to say, oh, the faith that we have doesn't encapsulate, like, a morsel of goodness for my sibling who also just so happens to have mental illness. Like, we couldn't pray it away. And it made him angrier. And there were times, there were a lot of times when I tried to put my own sibling in a box. And that box had different names according to the faith tradition I was in. It was sinfulness. It was demonic. It was a lot of other things. But maintaining this relationship with my sibling really helped me see, know, and understand, and also like question things that I held true, that I thought I held true to. But one of my coping mechanisms for so much of my life was hyper-intellectualizing. So even as like a youngster, I was just like trying to intellectualize his life and not applying it to my own life. And I think with each step of my faith journey, it was less about him and more about me until finally it was like, oh, it's not that it's not working for him. It's that I'm really projecting what I'm feeling, but I haven't assessed whether or not it's working for me. And there are bits and pieces that I loved of every faith step that I was in. But just because you love bits and pieces doesn't mean that the whole is good. And that's something that I'm still on my journey of pursuing, where I'm like, I like this, but I really don't like these other things.
So how would you say, you're talking about how you're very spiritual. Do you still feel like you have a relationship with the church or a church?
Or is it?
Yeah.
We're like, there is a church that we go to on Sundays, not every Sunday. Cause wow, I really, mm-hmm. Now that I'm older, I'm like, maybe just twice a month is great. I preach at a church. I am fairly active in a church, and then also have colleagues who are church planters or pastors that I interact with, and I preach at their churches too. So I'm very, I'm pretty involved in the church. Mm-hmm. There's just this ongoing practice of giving myself space to not fall into the same rhythms and patterns that I was in before, like falling into them blindly. I'm able to say, it's okay if we don't go to this thing. And it's okay if we're not doing this all the time, which is very interesting because I have 3 kids and they're 2, 5, and 7. So I'm like in the thick of it. And church is a big part of their lives. It's a big part of their community. And what I'm grateful for our church is that it is led by psychologists who do work in deconstruction, who do work with Christian leadership, who do work with like crises, a lot of people who are in crisis. And a big part of the church that we're involved with is like, how do we create a trauma-informed community with our own children? And so I look at church as, yes, this is a big part of my spirituality, but it's also a big part of my own children's development. Like, I want to make sure that they have the people that they can trust outside of mommy and daddy that they can seek and talk to. But I also want to make sure that those people that they trust and seek and talk to can hold hard things instead of like passing the buck. So yeah, I'm still active in church. It is an ongoing process.
Would you say that you may have inherited a little bit of that spirit of protest as you're navigating church spaces?
Oh, the spirit of protest is always in me. Doesn't leave. I silenced it for a very long time, but I've always been a problem, I should say.
Your community sounds very authentic. And one that you and your family, as you were saying, participate, and it serves a purpose both on a level of spirituality, but also as you were just saying about how your children are brought up around faith and seeing it in a much different way. So it's refreshing to hear that, because when I think about the buildings and communities that are going to survive what we're going through now, will be the ones like the community that you're a part, while the other ones that are the patriarchal, top-down, male-dominated, white, cisgender, et cetera, even the one that I'm a part of, it still has a heavy patriarchy about it. And it is, the future is not there. The future are in those communities like yours that you build by design, and people are collaborative by nature, and that it's a bottom up, not top down, where we're all equals in the sense we should be. We get to share our experiences. So it sounds like it's a very healthy and healing place for you to be. That's exciting. I wish all of our siblings could do that. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm so happy for you.
So I was like not really wanting to be in a church again. And I was talking to my friend who is a spiritual director. So I already knew that I was going to get Jenny. Talking to her about it. And what she had said was, like, the process of choosing a church is you're just choosing what mess you want to be in. Is the mess worth it?
Wow. And I'm like, oh. Wow, that's a fresh perspective.
It sounds healthy, but it's still the mess that I chose. There's still things in it that I'm like, oh, man, this is so sloppy.
I love that.
My own agency.
I freaking love that. Camille, you are a number of years younger than me, and I grew up at a time when it was a bad thing for people to go to do what was called church shopping, right? What are you doing that's around churches or anything else like this? And what you're talking about, what we're discussing here is that's exactly like, I am going to choose deliberately the community that I'm going to be part of, even if it is going to be a mess, but I'm going to pick that mess by design.
But church shopping is like more consumptive, right? Oh, I'm church shopping. I want to see what experience I'm getting. That what's the flavor? What tastes good? Versus choosing your masses. Okay, when the bottom's out, do I want to stay? You know, and I think I'm not writing about this extensively in my book, but like we've been in, my husband's a pastor's kid. And so we have been in a lot of situations where we're like just in relationship with people when their church fell out, whether it was through like pastoral abuse or, well, a lot of the cases it's pastoral abuse, but whether it's just through pastoral abuse funding, a lot of other reasons, we just so happen to have a relationship with people at the time. Yeah. And it has been interesting to be on the side of the onlooker, like the trusted onlooker, because we're like, there are things that we see where we're like, okay, one of the reasons why this isn't working out well is because you still want to consume church. But if you're consuming a relationship, then it goes with the definition of patriarchy that I set out in my book, that it is only for power and taking. There's no mutuality, no reciprocating relationship. And it is very interesting.
You touch on that in your book also in a different element that really draws it out when you talk about baptism and how we have made it consumer, transactional in nature, right? That's saving that moment to draw in. And I love that you draw that out. Can you talk a little bit more about that perspective?
But I'll cry for a baptism. Like, I'm to the waterworks of them. But it is interesting, in my opinion, because what is meant to be transformative becomes very transactional and performative. So, for example, like, a few years ago, like a decade ago, my mom and my godmother and her boyfriend did the Holy Land pilgrimage. And it's all there's a lot of complexities in it. But when they came back, my godmother's boyfriend was like baptized in the Jordan River and like held it as this like chip on his shoulder. It's this thing that he did. And I remember I couldn't describe what the ick was, like what was so icky. And it wasn't until much later that I was like, oh, it's because it was this experience that really became this show and this like performative edge he had to reveal like how much holier he was. When for me, it was like, dude, I can't even afford like a plane ticket to get there. And don't get me wrong, like I've been baptized a number of times, which is another funny story, but it was almost like this touristy thing. And I know that like baptism on a local level, you don't really consider it to be like touristy because you live in the area, but it has that same edge. I got baptized. Look at these pictures of me getting baptized. This is what happened. Wasn't it so great? All these people came, or none of these people. There is this quality to me that's, I'm really excited for you. At the same time, did you change? My husband's former stepdad, who was the reverend of the church that we had, the Black Missionary Baptist Church that we were attending, former stepdad would say, you can go in the water, like a person and come out of the water just the wet sinner. This doesn't really make a difference. Did your life change? Or he would say like a wet devil. Like, you're like a wet devil. Did your life really change? It's just water. And so there's,
yeah. I guess especially, I'm looking online. You can buy a I was baptized in the Jordan River t-shirt.
See? Tourists, like, Trinity Junction.
You totally can. Yeah. And they're probably selling them, like, right down the street from there.
Oh, 100%. There has to be a vendor.
Yeah. If not, I'm going to go set up the booth. Right? We should probably start. I want to talk, make sure that we make time to talk about the book itself, which I'm going to try to get. It's The Hero and the Whore, right?
Yes.
And that title is so evocative. I was talking with my wife earlier. She's like, "Who are you talking to today?" I said, we're talking about a book that's lessons of women who've been sexually exploited in the Bible. That's the best way that I could define it. I'm sure I'm not giving it any of the depth that it needs. And she's like, "Wow, that sounds really powerful. Like, definitely different than what I hear across the pulpit." Yeah. But do you want to talk a little bit about the title and what the theme of the book actually is? Not my short summary.
Yeah, the underlying theme of the book is, or the underlying thing, I shouldn't say the theme. The underlying thing of the book is, what if we took a trauma-informed lens towards the Bible and looked at stories that are cast off to the side because it is hard to extract victory out of them? What if we said, actually, victory is not the goal. The goal is to continue building a liberative community. And so we learn from the actions of those who were exploited in the Bible, but also looking at the actions of those who were exploited and survived exploitation throughout history. And in my context, I'm Black and Filipino, so I write very specifically about my two communities, because as a Black woman, there is just the history of misogynoir, of enslavement, of displacement. But also as a Filipina, there is a very specific history of coming from the country that is known as the doorway to the East by the United States military, which used Manifest Destiny, which is just a theology of conquest, to take advantage of our island nation.
Yeah.
Is looking at the at what does healing and liberation look like? From all of these examples that were not made up, they're all true stories. What does it look like for us if we learned from them?
Oh, wow. So they're like case studies of ways to learn from trauma.
100%.
These kind of stories that are under, they're probably stories that are not paid a lot of attention to in the Bible.
Or they're just bypassed. What if we actually named the harmful person as harmful? What happens to our faith? And I'm thinking specifically, like, David was a rapist. Why is it so hard to say that?
Wow.
Yeah, why is it so hard to say that? But again, we don't live in a society that can hold nuance. We live in a society that's, no, he has to be a good guy in order for us to feel like that we're good guys. So, well, then it's okay, then the benchmark or the goalpost for good changes, because you're saying that he sure is does. Good despite the bad things that he's done. That means that you can do bad things and still see yourselves as good. What does that create?
I think there, Camille, you've just stumbled onto something very big, because we see that done continually by folks that believe exactly that back to the baptism and being saved and everything is pure justification at that point based on, on their faith and in whatever, even with biblical inerrancy, even though it's twisted logic inside of that, there are folks who will do exactly that. They will find the good and just bypass the bad. Oh,
100%.
That's just we're not going to talk about that part.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've heard sermons or just had conversations where you don't have to be perfect for God to love you. God loves and uses flawed people. Look at the examples of Moses and Abraham, and even David wasn't perfect, but that's as far as they go. It's not like Moses was a murderer. Abraham trafficked his wife. As you said, David is a rapist. That's a really shocking statement, but it's 100% true. It's just very hard to vocalize.
It is. And then it also comes down to, I've really had to renegotiate my understanding of faith through that. Because I'd have to tell myself, like, actually, faith is about survival. And people make really bad decisions when they are trying to survive on their own, right? But then when people, when you reach outside of the scope of yourself and that there are other people that you are responsible for, if we understand life in the scope of the collective, then we are able to live more faithfully because we are held accountable to the collective. And in that way, I say, faith is about survival, but where does your perspective go? Because it's not, please don't have a rugged individual survivalist mentality that doesn't do anyone any good, not even yourself. Would that even be considered living faithfully? I mean, these are questions I'm constantly asking and renegotiating and like trying to make sure that I have language that can be specific to that.
These truths that you bring out, I love them. They are very uncomfortable. They're icky. They're just not easy Thanksgiving meal conversation.
Of course not. They're gooey. They're ooey gooey.
Yeah. And I love that. Your perspective of it, you just said something that just is so powerful, that how faith is an act of survival. And I guess I have not thought about it. So can you share a little bit more how you got there? What do you mean by that?
I think I come from a heritage of faithful people. As I've said before, like I come from a very praying family, and they are my North Star when it comes to trying to figure out like how am I negotiating and navigating through this. Because when the Japanese imperialist Japan took over the Philippines and were like kidnapping girls left and right to turn them into comfort women, you know, human trafficking victims.
Yeah.
I come from the Filipinos who hid in caves and prayed for protection. And for me, it's, that is faithfulness, that they hid in caves, prayed for protection, became guerrilla warriors, fighting the imperialist army. That is who I come from. But even now, sure, I didn't get to see that. And like the uncles that were alive then and my grandparents who were alive then, they all passed away. But now that they're in, this country's not new to them. They've been here for 40 years. But even as I live here in the United States, they still were able to build community, and they meet once a week at my godmother's house to pray. And it's something that, like, it's so beautiful to me that that's still a tradition that they have. And it's not just the act of prayer, because we're Filipino, we eat so much. So, like, we pray, and then there's a huge meal, and then we're Southeast Asian, so we, like, gamble. It's a very big part of our culture. And so they're, like, playing bingo or mahjong or something. And there's just this, like, collective togetherness that helps them get through and not have to negotiate their identities as Asian American immigrants. But that is also what faithfulness looks like, because it goes back to being a part of the collective and being accountable for each other. And even myself, who, like, I don't hang out with them once a week, but when I see them, I'm held accountable to them. And also just like how those traditions raise my children, because to my daughter, it's so normal. To my son, it's so normal. To the point where they're talking about it in class, like, oh yeah, one of the traditions that we have is that we like go and pray at my grandmother's house. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's so beautiful. The context of that is that our faithfulness helps us survive, not just survive as immigrants in a foreign land, but survive in a way that we don't have to negotiate who we are, but we're also able to share resources with one another and extend care to one another. So that is one example, one very concrete and lovely example that I have of faithfulness being about survival.
Yeah, one of the things that I found interesting looking through the book is how you pull these stories through to modern real world implications based on each of them, that there's implications in healthcare and how women and people of color are treated in the healthcare system. There's implications in policing and how we manage our communities. It's just interesting that these, finding this real world modern relevance in these survival stories that you've uncovered.
Yeah, I think that was, I always knew that was going to happen, that I was going to extend it beyond just the story of the Bible. But actually, I feel like it actually got like way past my own vision as I was writing. And I was like, oh, we're getting, I need to write about this, or I need to add this. To the point where there was like one chapter where my editor was like, I'm going to cut it here. And I was like, okay.
Thank God for editors.
But I had read South to America a little bit before it got picked up for the book deal. And I remember reading it and being like, this is incredible. How the way that I can explain it is you're like circling the drain. That you are, the drain is the topic. But in order to get to the topic, you have to go this roundabout way. Until you get there. But when you go to the roundabout way, you take the reader on this whole journey to see all of these missing links. And then once you get to that center piece, the reader is able to say, oh, all of this makes sense to me. And I was really hoping that that writing method would be something that was less dense, but also more tangible for readers.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see how these stories, you pull all the way through to like the shooting of Breonna Taylor. Or the fact that Black women aren't getting the pain medication that they need in the healthcare system. That there's all these different ways that these lenses that we can look at the community through.
Thank you. I think, yeah. When I was in the Black Missionary Baptist Church, it was the only like really Black church in a very white community. And so our ministry efforts were very much about, we're going to get together on a Saturday and clean the church. It was very much about ourselves and our community. And I think, I know that there's a reason for it, like a purpose for it. But what I also wanted to say was like, no, we can, as Christians, we have a responsibility to extend care. But what if we looked at care in these other ways? What if we looked at ministry as how do we stop the Black maternal health crisis? How do we take care of Black girls so that they're not over-sexualized in their school? But how do you do that in a way that honors their agency instead of reprimanding them? And it's the ways that we do in purity culture. So I just wanted to bend and reshape our understanding of service beyond what is currently known, which are usually forms of like self-protection that we see that's happening in the church.
Purity culture, you bring that up, and we've seen that. That's made its way through the churches. And I don't, do you write about that in your book here?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I have lots.
I'm a loaded question, and I was hoping you would have.
I appreciate a loaded question. Don't worry. My thoughts on purity culture is, it's a chapter on Potiphar's wife, which is funny because maybe 7 years ago, I was like, I want to write a book about her specifically. So that was probably like the first seed that I planted about this book. So that is so interesting that we don't know her by name. I was like, that's such a thing of disrespect. And I know her by her actions. But for me, and specifically with the chapter and the conversation of purity culture, was I wanted to talk about how it impacts the brain development, especially since purity culture targets teenagers. And also, I wanted to talk about the relationship between purity culture and the military-industrial complex. Purity culture is a tool used for war and recruitment, but also puts pressure of national security on removing bodily autonomy from whole communities. But then also another degree of it was that conversation changes according to identity. So I could say it relinquishes your bodily autonomy, but it's not the same for a cishet woman as it is for a queer, non-binary trans person. So it's just, my gripe about conversations of purity culture is that they really do focus on one identity, and that's usually like the identity of women specifically white women, but I've seen works on purity culture from African-American and Asian women and Latin. But yeah, my gripe about purity culture is if we're really going to address it, instead of addressing the like hyper individual focus, like this is what happened to me, this is how I feel, we need to instead focus on who is capitalizing. And in my case, with the book that I was writing, it was like, actually, the church is capitalized. And so does the nation. And so does the fact that, like, the United States is the number one most militarized country in the world. And in some facet, it's benefiting from that too. Yeah. It was a very large line that I drew. The dots are connected.
So this book, I asked you at the top of the conversation, who did you write it for? You said yourself. And then I'm thinking, of course, that's a good start, a place in which to start. And I'm glad you did that. I'm just thinking, though, this book should be read by everybody. Unfortunately, some cannot handle rigorous honesty that you put forth in this and connecting these dots. But I do hope that this book gets in the hands of many, because what you write about is needs to be said more. And it also reflects your journey of finding your own authenticity and processing what's right for you. And isn't that the call of us in our most closeness with our own divinity and what we're called to be? Yeah. And fulfillment. No, I am myself. You're talking about that autonomy just now in the purity culture. And things are robbed from us left and right. And we're just broken into these things or shoved into boxes. And we have to be identified this way or that way. That's good or bad. And the binaryism of all of that too. And your book just blows that all apart left and right. And using your stories, it's a beautiful way to show how we all could be our authentic selves.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. You're reminding me that my writing style, a lot of the book was not a little, just very upfront. And I remember having some people say that my writing style was brash. And I was like, it was a lot more vulgar in earlier drafts. Uh-huh. And not my editor, but the copy editor was like, do you want to use this language? It's quite vulgar. And I was like, all right, I'll think about it. But it is it is a little dialed down, just a little bit, but yeah, it's one of those things where I don't know how else to confront hard things without having without presenting the truth in a very honest way. And the unfortunate part of it is like any presentation of the truth is going to be hard to anyone, but also I'm a poet and I'm very like meticulous about my words. So there's a part of me that's like, yes, that did come off a little brash, but at least you listened, you know?
Got your attention now. One question I want to ask is, it's not lost on me that as part of this conversation, I am a white, middle-class, cis man who has benefited in so many ways from a lot of the systems that you talk about. And I, for one, find it refreshing to be confronted with these issues and to be inspired to repent and decolonize and work to break down some of these systems. But there are a lot of people in my position who would look at this book and go, oh, here we go again. I'm gonna have to feel bad for being who I am, even though I didn't do it, even though you probably did at some point. Do you have a message, or what would you say to somebody who is at one of those intersections benefiting from these systems and how they might benefit from reading your book?
Yeah. The only thing that comes to mind is that I don't take responsibility for someone else's emotional immaturity. If someone is going to read my book and say that they feel guilt, that they don't want to feel guilty, it's not my fault. Right?
That is fair.
I cried over this book. I was haunted over this book. I was angry over this book. I have gone through a gambit of emotions in resurrecting these stories and writing these histories and connecting these dots, I did the hardest work possible so that someone else could read it. And I'm not saying that reading it is not the hardest work possible, because we can't speak on behalf of someone else's emotional labor or intellectual labor.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say that I did my work. You do yours. And if you don't want to do it, it's not on me. It's like what it comes down to.
Amen. Amen. I hear that. I hear that. So thank you for that. I know that was probably not an easy question to answer. So thank you.
It's actually a lot easier than you think it is. It is a personal problem, and I am not the person.
You say it so clearly and so honestly, because it reminds me of conversations that I've had over the last few years in the what it is to talk about how do we make amends for slavery and for as a white dude. I'm queer myself, but still I present myself as this white dude. And that's riddled with privilege. And so the point I'm laboring to make is that at some level, I felt like I was asking people to tell me to tell me how I should feel. And you're not the first to say it this way. Then said, that's actually on you to go. You go do the hard work and then we'll have that conversation. But unfortunately for a lot of white folks, let's just put it out there, because Kelly and I've had other conversations and on Radical Love Live about this very thing, where you have to meet that person where they are as well. Don't make them do the work for you. Okay. You've got to take this journey. You've got to get there. If you want to understand what it's like for somebody else, then you need to do your research and feel your way through that, so that you learn it, you embody yourself, and then you can have a true deep conversation with that individual. But don't expect them to be your teacher.
Yeah. It's like a James Baldwin quote. He said, the role of an artist is like that of a lover. And just like a lover, I'm helping you see what you were unconscious to. And so for me, I put a lot of love into this. And you got it. I put a lot of love into this because I am an artist, because I'm a lover.
Yeah.
To love back is your responsibility. But if you can't, then I know where you are right now.
Right,
and I've been heartbroken enough times to know what this feeling is like, but also to not be deterred by it.
And hopefully this book can soften the hearts of some of those who might be resistant to it and would touch the hearts of those that are open to it.
Yeah. Thank you. That is my prayer for the book all day, every day. And I'm thankful that you are engaging in that same prayer with me.
We are. Yeah, it is always so simple to say it's about love, but it is about love. Love for ourselves, love for our neighbors, that living authentically, breaking down this junk that we get ourselves exposed to, part of those traditions and whatnot. But ultimately, when you strip it all away, what's it all about? It's about love. It's about our neighbor. It's about moving us toward a better experience than where we rather than when we're in division and binaryism and those things like that. And your book does a brilliant job on breaking through that.
Thank you. Love is more complicated than we think it is.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. and not bypassing things once you've seen them. That's the thing. There's a lot of the truths that you talk about. Like once you see them, you have a choice. You can either act on this. You can either realize that you're connected with community, or as many do, you can tuck it away and bypass it.
Yeah, you're forever changed.
That's an important responsibility and part of love. Yeah.
Well, Camille, thank you. This has been an extraordinary conversation. Your book is now available, Hero and the Whore. You find it on everywhere I've seen, right? Amazon, Books a Million, you've got it everywhere. And are you out there in the world? Are you doing any kind of book readings, or are you getting out in space with the book?
I'm just wrapping up my virtual tour, and then I'm going to take a little break so that I can prepare for hopefully an in-person tour in the summertime.
Great.
I really need this break. That's what I'm just trying to say. I just really Yeah, I really need the break. But I do have a Substack where I try to share at least a weekly post, whether it be an essay or a digital zine. And yeah, that is my first and last name, .substack.com. So CamilleHernandez.substack.com, where I am the most accessible.
Awesome. And for any of our listeners who want to respond to this conversation, Radical Love Live is also on Facebook, Instagram, X, formerly known as Twitter. So when we post this episode, you can also respond. And if you have questions or comments for Camille, we'll make sure that those get to her.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Camille.
Thank you for being here. We really appreciated it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Radical Love Live, co-hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson. All rights reserved. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, and other popular podcast platforms. Go to RadicalLoveLive.com to learn more about us, watch recordings of our live events, and listen to our podcast. We also invite you to check out what Kelly and Mark are doing by going to our websites. Find Kelly at KellyWilson.com and Mark at MarkDilcom.com. This is Radical Love Live, where we explore faith outside the boxes.